Welcome to The McCarthy Report, the podcast where you would normally hear Rich Lowry and Andy McCarthy discuss the latest legal and national security issues. Rich is out this week, so you're hearing me, Noah Rothman, instead. This week, we will discuss, what else? The first week of Donald Trump's first and perhaps only criminal trial to go to court, at least this year. Also, the Supreme Court hears arguments in a case that could overturn some January 6th convictions. But there's a lot more going on in the world than just Trump's travails, and we'll discuss those events too. If for some reason you aren't following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Please give this podcast and Annie McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star review he deserves on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this podcast none other than its host, Andy McCarthy. Hey, Andy.
Noah, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it. We have a lot to unpack. This is going to be helpful for me, I suspect, as much as our audience. So jury selection is underway in Trump's trial in New York City. This is the case brought by Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. It's commonly euphemized as the porn star hush money case. Let's begin with a quick refresher for the audience and me on what the charges are, how the prosecution has spun up this misdemeanor case so it could also be a felony, and what the prosecution's theory of how it can get to a conviction.
Technically, I guess it's the falsification of business records is the charge, but it's good that we go back over this because I should start by saying it looks like the anticipation that it would take a very long time to pick a jury and that we might be at the beginning of May before we got to opening statements, which was what the general feeling was Monday when the trial formally began with jury selection. That looks like it's completely wrong. It looks like we could
actually saying we can get to arguments by Monday. Now,
yeah. Right? So the pace was so glacial on Monday that I think it misled people into thinking that it was going to take much longer, especially because the first half day was taken up with a lot of legal argument. And then I think the other thing was people, including people in the Trump camp, seem to be under the misimpression that court would not sit at all Monday and Tuesday next week during Passover. Whereas, and then, you know, idiotically, one of the Trump people, I think it was Alina Habba, came out and said, you know, this judge, he won't even let Jews observe their holidays, which, of course, is not what Judge Merchant said. What he said was that, to the contrary, everyone will be accommodated regarding their religious observances, but he doesn't think that that necessarily requires taking off the full day on Monday and Tuesday. So at least one of those days is going to be a half day, Monday, and maybe Tuesday as well. So things are, you know, the calculations on which those estimates that this was going to, you know, take forever to pick a jury are wrong. And then there's two ways of picking a jury. There's the way the lawyers prefer and the way the judge prefers. The lawyers prefer a system where you know everything about who's coming when you exercise your challenges. And the judge likes a system where you get on with it. So the way this works in practice is he's going to sit 12 jurors and 6 alternates, and each side gets 10 peremptory challenges. So if you add that up, that's 38. So what the lawyers would like is you go through the whole veneer until you finally qualify 38 people. So then they can exercise their challenges knowing if I boot this juror, who's the next one who's coming up? Because I've already interviewed that person. The judge wants to get the trial rolling. So what the judge prefers is to qualify 18 people, not 38, and make them begin to exercise their challenges without knowing which juror would replace a juror who's already been qualified. So what has happened here is instead of going through the whole veneer and getting 38 people qualified and then starting to knock them off, which takes a long time, what Judge Merchant did was seat the first 96, get rid of all the people who had to be who had to get off the case because of, you know, they couldn't be fair, or they had work commitments that wouldn't allow them to serve, or whatever. And then he brought the next bunch in, and he kept interviewing people using this questionnaire where they get asked, you know, basically 42 questions with subparts, and the lawyers can do follow up and all that stuff. And he got to the point where he had 18. And once he had 18, rather than qualifying another 20, he made the lawyers start using their peremptory challenges. And when you do that, the chance you take is if a juror seems borderline acceptable, but you think or hope that you might get someone who might be better for you, if you know who's coming, that's an easy choice. If you don't know who's coming, you might boot somebody and get somebody worse. So it tends to accelerate the process, and it certainly has here. So while they had zero at the end of day one, they had seven by yesterday. And if they keep that pace up, they could actually have enough jurors by Friday to start the trial.
So before we get to the Bragg's theory of the case and the Trump defense, I want to read you this quote. You've probably heard it because I talked about it yesterday on the editor's podcast. It's from the New York Times. In anticipation of what the strategy was for jury selection from both legal teams. Quote, Mr. Trump's lawyers want a jury that includes younger black men and white working class men, particularly public employees like police officers, firefighters, and sanitation workers. Those who have had bad experiences with the legal system will also be prized by the defense, which has cast the case as politically motivated. Prosecutors, conversely, will probably be looking for more educated voters from Democratic neighborhoods, fishing for those who consume news from sources like MSNBC, and known for its outspoken legal hosts, and who are fond of late-night comedians like Stephen Colbert.
Yes.
obviously, trying to – this is like a theory of the election in microcosm from these two legal teams. Is that what we saw from the jury selection process, or was this just aspirational on the part of both legal teams?
It's aspirational, but it's like anything else. You know, it's like the plan doesn't survive first contact with reality, right? So, you know, you have this idea of who you want, and then New Yorkers start coming in, and they're not that easy to pigeonhole. I really like trying cases in front of New York juries, which were heavily laden with people from Manhattan. I think that's probably right in terms of what their ideal juror is. It's just that people don't tend to match your aspirational juror in a perfect way. And a lot of jury selection is just, you know, you do the best you can. And what you're really trying to weed out, to my mind, is people who want to be on the jury. You know, I think the best, there's been a lot of complaints about people coming in and saying they can't be fair. And, you know, some of the coverage on the right-leaning organs has been, see, Trump can't get a fair trial in New York. And I'm like, and maybe because this is what I used to do for a living, I'm like, if you really were unfair to the guy, what you would do is get yourself on the jury by assuring everyone that you could be fair, and then screw him once the trial starts. I have a lot of respect for people who come in and say in good faith, I can't be fair. That's actually a favor to Trump. It's not an indication that that the thing is rigged against him. There may be other indications of that, but I don't think this process is that. And what you really worry about, the other thing, Noah, we should make clear here, because there's been a lot of misinformation about this as well. There's a lot about, like, do you vote against Trump? Are you politically against Trump? Do you dislike Trump as a person? That's really not the inquiry in jury selection. In jury selection, you really don't want. I remember when we were picking a jury in the Blind Shea case, if you didn't know the World Trade Center was blown up, that would indicate to me that you'd been living under a rock for a couple of years before the trial, and therefore we didn't want you as a juror. You know, you don't want people who are completely detached from reality, and you don't want people who don't have thoughts or views. What you want are people who can be fair and who can convince you that whatever their predispositions may be, A, they're aware of them, and B, they can put them aside and decide the case based only on the evidence that gets presented in the trial. You know, I was on trial with a bunch of terrorists. Nobody likes terrorists. And most of these guys weren't pretending that they weren't terrorists, you know? So it's not a question of whether you like them personally or not, or even if you have political views that are opposite of theirs. The issue is, are you so impassioned by that or inflamed by that that you can't be fair, that you can't decide the case only on what you hear in the courtroom? So that's what you're trying to weed out. And if I were a lawyer picking a jury in a case like this, what I would be concerned about is the juror who sees this trial as his or her, you know, ticket to fame at the end.
And they focused a lot on ensuring anonymity of these jurors, which is going to be a difficult process, probably not just because of the interest of the media in this, but Judge Merchant's probably deserved focus on the effort to keep Donald Trump from divulging information about the ongoing case.
I suspect, though, that Merchant has not done this before in terms – I think he's an experienced judge. I would bet you he's never had an anonymous jury before, because a number of the jurors have been allowed to give answers that would make it easy to figure out who they were. And I've been involved in a number of cases in federal court, just across the street from where they're trying this case, where we've had anonymous juries. And even if you have a juror who you like, who seems promising in terms of being able to be qualified and to sit on the jury, if he or she gives an answer that makes their identity too easy to find out, that's like an automatic disqualification. Because if you're going to have an anonymous jury, you have to try to have an anonymous jury. So you don't want that kind of information coming out. And I don't think they've been careful enough about that. So far, some of the people who've been qualified have given details about particularly their work experience, which may make it easy for the media to figure out who they are, which kind of defeats the purpose of having an anonymous jury. But we'll see going forward whether that holds up or not.
Yeah. So let's get to the meat of the case here. You've talked about this before. Bragg's theory of the case, as I understand it, and you can correct me, is that if he can prove this second crime, that the falsification of business records was designed to further, then that's the gold ring here. But it's not the violation of state tax law, which is one of the possible secondary crimes that this was designed to advance. The big prize is proving the violation of federal tax law, which maintains essentially that the hush money payment was designed to conceal information from voters so relevant that it could have turned the tide in the 2016 election. Yeah?
Yeah, well, not tax law, but campaign finance law.
Campaign finance law on the federal side. State tax law for the New York side.
So here's
but that's not the big one. They want a felony conviction.
Yes, and that the way they get it, and this is so the simple way that this has been articulated is there's a misdemeanor New York falsification of business records statute that basically says if you put false information in your books and records with an intent to defraud. So that's now this is very important because it's not enough in the case. And this, I think, would be one of Trump's best defenses in the case. It's not enough to simply put down information that's wrong and to do so intentionally. It's supposed to be attached to a motive to defraud. And what fraud means, generally speaking, is a financial crime federally. In New York, they widen the scope a little bit to not just financial schemes, but deceptive schemes to get benefits by dishonest measures. But one way or another, you have to have that kind of a motivation to be guilty. And then the exacerbated crime, which is the felony, is if your fraudulent intent in falsifying the business records is the commission, it includes the commission or concealment of another crime. So either the commission of a crime that you want to commit or the concealment of a crime that you know you have committed. And it gets very slippery, Noah, because what Bragg points out is that he doesn't have to prove another crime. He has to prove that Trump intended to commit another crime. So I think that's – he's gotten a lot of criticism over the fact that the other crime that he's clearly relying on is a federal campaign finance violation. And I think part of the reason he's being weaselly about whether that's really what he's trying to do here or not is he's basically saying, look, I don't have to prove a federal campaign violation. I only have to prove that Trump intended to commit one. And the thing I, as a lawyer and someone who's worked in the criminal law for a very long time, I find this an offensive argument because what Bragg is essentially trying to suggest is that his burden of proof is lesser or lower than what it actually is. When he says, I don't have to prove another crime, I just have to prove he intended to commit another crime, that's like, I don't have to have very strong evidence of the objective that Trump had here. And the law actually works the opposite way. The way, generally speaking in the law, the more you have a crime that requires a completed act, the less that you require in the way of intent proof, because people are generally presumed to intend the consequences of their actions, right? So if you have a bank robbery case, it's not very hard to prove intent in a bank robbery case because the act basically speaks for itself. Nobody goes in and demands money that they, you know, under the circumstances of a bank robbery by intimidation. Nobody does that by accident or mistake. So the time that you spend proving up intent in a bank robbery case is about a nanosecond because everybody knows what the bank robber is up to, right? On the other hand, the more inchoate a crime is, the higher your level of evidence is supposed to be that the person actually intended to commit the crime. So for example, in intent law, attempt law, if you want to charge somebody with attempted bank robbery or attempted murder, the law requires not only proof that they specifically intended to commit the crime, but also a substantial step in the direction of committing the crime. So for example, even if you and I talked about doing a bank robbery, even if we really intended to do it, that probably wouldn't be enough evidence to say that we attempted to do it. We'd have to do something like go out and get masks or go out and get a car to be the getaway car or something that corroborated our intent. So generally in the law, the further away you are from the commission of a hard, unambiguous crime, the more the criminal law generally requires an intent proof so that you can be satisfied that if you're going to punish somebody for their thoughts and their aspirations or their objectives, that you're confident that they really had a criminal objective. And here what I see Bragg doing is he doesn't want to cop to the fact that he's trying to prove a campaign finance violation that he doesn't have jurisdiction to prove because he's a state prosecutor, and that the two federal agencies that have jurisdiction, both the Justice Department, including under Biden, and the Federal Election Commission, both looked at this in connection with Trump and decided not to proceed against him. So I think, you know, Dan McLaughlin's written a lot about this that's been very good. I've written a few pieces on it myself. It's very puzzling to people who do this for a living why Bragg doesn't want to just come out and say, here's what the objective crime was. But he's been a weasel about it from the beginning. And I think the reason is he knows he's on very thin ice with what he's trying to pull off here.
And yet you have, you seem to assume, if I'm reading you right, that he's going to get a pretty friendly hearing from the jury on at least some of these 34 counts. And I want to get to that briefly, but help me understand. There was not a lot of action in the early days of these proceedings. It's mostly just jury selection, obviously. But something that was litigated was an effort to introduce the Access Hollywood tape into proceedings.
Correct.
And it's talk about people living under a rock. If you don't if you haven't encountered the Access Hollywood tape over the last 7 years, where have you been? But they couldn't. So that wasn't, Judge Merchant did not allow the tape itself to be played, but you could be introduced as evidence in a transcript. I can't imagine anybody doesn't know about this, but what is that designed to advance in the prosecution's estimation? How does this further their case?
So the big hole, one of the big holes in Bragg's case is that, well, I guess I want to start out by saying the biggest hole in Bragg's case is the thing he actually wants to charge is not a crime. In this way, it's very much like the Fannie Willis prosecution in Atlanta. She wants to charge this big conspiracy to overturn the result of the 2020 election. And the problem she has is it's not a crime to try to overturn the result of an election. There's a process in every state in the union for challenging election results. Here, Bragg wants to charge a conspiracy or a fraudulent scheme to intercept or basically to catch, as they put it, unflattering, unsavory information about Trump and suppress it from voters in the 2016 election. And the problem he has is it's simply not a crime to do that. And in fact, it's like something politicians do. You know, it's not just politicians who do it. We all do it. You know, you have things in your background that you don't want to have flaunted. And you know, people take steps to suppress them. Here, obviously, there's a lot more to it because there's a campaign. But it's not, in principle, it's not a crime to suppress information. Unless the only time it's a crime is if there's some legal obligation to reveal
it. I mean, it's obviously impossible that he can't prove a negative that the fact that this information did not come out during the 2016 campaign materially altered the trajectory of the election to an outcome altering degree. Can't prove that. He can stipulate it, I suppose, but how do you get to the point at which you convince a jury that, well, maybe, I guess, possibly, and even then, how is it relevant?
Yeah. So on the point that you just made, which I think is an excellent point about how, proving a negative and what was the impact, I would point out how wrong this is for Bragg to be doing this, because he is the Manhattan district attorney, right? If there's one thing we know, it's that whatever Trump did in New York, it didn't work. Hillary Clinton won New York in a landslide. There's nothing that Trump did here that had any consequence of the election in New York. So what you have is the Manhattan district attorney wants to charge a scheme that basically Trump stole the 2016 election by fraud. And he's groping for a statute to hang that theory on because he doesn't really have something that's actually a crime. If he did, he would charge a fraud scheme or, you know, some kind of a conspiracy. He doesn't have it. And then the other, who is he acting on behalf of? Who is he protecting here? Because his job is the people in Manhattan. It's not Democrats across the United States who are upset that Hillary Clinton didn't win the election, you know? So I think it's very presumptuous and wrong for him to be bringing the case on that theory when obviously there wasn't any consequence out of all this in New York. And it's not his business to vindicate the, you know, whatever rights are had by voters outside of New York. But that's his theory, that Trump stole the 2016 election. And the hole in his case is that the 34 charges you refer to, Noah, all take place between February and December of 2017. So he's in a position of arguing that the 2016 election was stolen by crimes that were not committed until 2017, which doesn't make logical sense. So how is he trying to pull this off? He's trying to broaden out the scope from Stormy Daniels to something bigger than that, which is this is how we get to the Access Hollywood tape. He files a narrative statement, a statement of facts, in conjunction with the indictment. The indictment's returned by the grand jury. It's pretty much just a bare bones allegation of 34 counts. And when I say bare bones, it really just goes through what the statutes are that Trump allegedly violated. In conjunction with that, he submits a statement of facts, which is not – this is his statement of facts. This is not the grand jury. Usually in a grand jury indictment, you know, it's all one package in the indictment where you tell the story. Here, Bragg didn't do that. He did his own little statement of facts that he put out with the grand jury indictment. And what the statement of facts says is that in 2015, Trump got together with Michael Cohen, who was working for him at the time, his so-called fixer, who's a lawyer but really doesn't have any clients other than in connection loosely with his work in the Trump organization. And then the other person who's relevant here is David Pecker, who at the time was the CEO of the American Media Inc., which ran the National Enquirer. So they have this scheme beginning in 2015 that they're going to try to catch and kill stories about Trump that are uncomplimentary. And there's no doubt that the election is factoring in. This is the election is the whole reason why they're doing this. So there are three different allegations of catch and kill in the indictment. One involves Stormy Daniels, which is the one the 34 counts are about. One involves this woman, Karen McDougal, a Playboy model who says she had an affair with Trump in 2006. And I sort of can't believe that Trump is actually still denying that. But I think at least the public position he's taking is that there was no affair. And then there's this guy called Dino. His last name escapes me for the moment, but he's known as Dino the Doorman. And he was a doorman at Trump Tower. He believed, or at least he said he believed, that Trump had an affair with someone on the domestic staff of his home in Trump Tower, and that he impregnated the woman and that she had to have an abortion. The National Enquirer ended up paying him $30,000 for his story. The way catch and release works is you get paid by a publication for the exclusive rights to your story, and then you can't tell it publicly anywhere else, otherwise you can be sued. So that's how it works. So they paid him $30,000 for that story, and then they investigated it and they determined that it wasn't true. But with respect to the other two, McDougal got paid $150,000. It sounds like she got duped in the sense that she was enticed not only by the money, but she was told that she would get some modeling gigs and be able to write, I think, an exercise and health and fitness column for the National Enquirer. She never got the modeling gig. She never got the column, but she got the money. And that to get that, she gave the exclusive rights to her story. And then the other thing, of course, is Stormy Daniels. So what Bragg is trying to do here is camouflage the fact that his case doesn't make sense because it's 2017 crimes that are said to have influenced the 2016 election. And he's bringing that again because he obviously doesn't have a crime that he'd like to charge, which is here's what happened between 2015 and 2016 that I can charge as a crime that shows that Trump tried to improperly influence the outcome of the election. He doesn't have that. So he's trying, and so far the judge is accommodating him, to prove up this scheme that isn't actually a crime that goes from 2015 through 2017. And I think he's going to try to hoodwink the jury into believing that this is all one series of continuing activity that goes from 2015 through 2017, rather than the way they should think of it, which is 34 allegations of crime that happened in 2017. The judge is letting him prove up this whole scheme on the idea that it's background to the crime and it's necessary information for the jury to understand the aspects of the Stormy Daniels transaction which result in these payments. I actually think that's nonsense. If I were the judge, you can easily understand the 34 falsification of business records counts without having to have all this other information come in. But Merchan is allowing him to do this. The reason for the admission of the Access Hollywood tape is that the idea is that in the tape comes out in, I think, October 5th or October 7th of 2016. And the idea is once that tape came out, Trump could not afford to have another disclosure of a sexual nature come out, or his campaign would have been harpooned. I mean, the tape itself almost harpooned his campaign, right? So after that tape came out, Stormy Daniels increased the pressure to get paid, or she was going to go public with her story. And the idea is that the pressure of the Access Hollywood tape and the leverage that it gave her is the reason why Trump and Cohen, who were hoping not to pay Stormy, they figured if they could string her along until after the election, then they could basically tell her to get lost.
I mean, that the fact pattern you lay out, if you didn't think the whole theory of the case was bunk, would seem to advance Bragg's theory of the case.
That's right. And the problem with it is, and this is hard for non-lawyers, but it's, you know, this is just a fact of the criminal law.
I mean, who are you talking to here?
Well, yeah, right. but there's a difference between saying the election gave her leverage, or the election was the reason that something happened, was the motivating factor for something to happen, versus saying that something is a campaign expenditure under federal campaign finance law. Technically speaking, campaign expenditures are things that are expenses that, but for the existence of the campaign, would not be expenses. So they're things like polling, you know, things like common campaign expenses. They are not independent debts or debts that would exist even if the campaign didn't happen. So, for example, if Trump hadn't been a candidate for president, Stormy Daniels could still threaten Trump, I'm going to go public about our relationship if you don't pay me. He has more of an incentive to pay her if he cares about being elected to public office. But her demand on him and the debt that creates is not campaign related, even if the campaign gives Trump more motive to pay it. And it's probably the easiest way to understand this is to flip it around. If Bragg's theory was correct, then Trump could pay porn stars out of campaign money, which I don't think anybody would think was a proper campaign expenditure. So this is undoubtedly the reason why when the Justice Department looked at this, they decided not to bring a case. And when the FEC looked at this, they didn't bring a case, any action against Trump, even though, you know, they could have demanded a civil settlement or something of that kind, if they had believed that he was in violation of the law. But I simply think that they didn't believe they had any chance of proving a campaign finance violation. And that kind of brings us to what I regard as the big problem in this case, both constitutionally, policy-wise, and factually. The reason that Congress created the Federal Election Commission to enforce these laws in addition to the Justice Department, which has a whole section that specializes in this area, is we want campaign finance law to be enforced uniformly across the country. And what we have here is the two federal agencies that Congress has authorized to enforce these laws looked at this and decided not to bring it. Bragg is bringing it, with trying not to say he's bringing it, because I think he understands that he's, again, on thin ice with respect to this. But in doing this, he's making up his own campaign finance law as he goes along and using standards that would not be the standards used by the Justice Department, the Federal Election Commission. And I think when he gets called on it, what he says is, but I don't have to prove a violation. I only have to prove that Trump intended to commit a violation. But in the law, if that's where you're coming from, you should have better proof of a campaign finance violation, not weaker proof.
All right. Well, we could talk about this all day. I want to get off of it. But before we do, I've gotten the sense from your commentary previously and in our conversation today that you don't have a ton of faith in Judge Juan Merchan to behave as anything other than a doormat for the prosecution. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Correct me if I'm wrong. But did you get any impression from these last 2 days of proceedings that we're going to see something that's a little more adversarial to the Manhattan DA?
Yeah, I do. I think it's to the extent I jump to the conclusion that he's just another Judge Engoron. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably not right. Now, he certainly has leaned over backwards to accommodate Bragg's theory of the case, and the rulings have substantially gone in Bragg's direction. However, he's made a couple of rulings in the last couple of days that are favorable to Trump. Now, I believe they're rulings he had to make, but nevertheless, he should get credit for doing. I've given him enough criticism for not doing what he should do, so I think he gets credit for making rulings that that were consistent with the law. One is, you mentioned the Access Hollywood tape. The other thing Bragg wanted to do is prove up, a la the E. Jean Carroll case, a couple of other instances of alleged sexual improprieties by Trump. And his rationalization for being allowed to do that was that it's important to his case to establish that Trump was worried that all kinds of allegations could have come out against him, and therefore he needed to have this scheme to catch and bury these stories. That's not really, it's hard to take that with a straight face. I mean, obviously what Bragg was trying to do here is get as much unsavory information about Trump in front of the jury as he could, along the lines of, you know, the practice of trying to say to the jury, you know, look, he's a bad guy. He must have done what he's been accused of. Merchan is not going to allow that to happen. I think he threw Trump not much of a bone by saying he wouldn't let the jury hear the tape, but he's going to let them get a redacted transcript with some of Trump's statements in it. I mean, to me, that's, you get the statements one way or the other. I know the tape sounds worse than the transcript reads, but still, that's not much of a concession to Trump there. But it is important to rule that he's not going to allow Bragg to bring in these other women who claim that Trump sexually abused them. That may have been appropriate in the E. Jean Carroll case, because in the area, when there are sexual abuse charges, the law has actually made accommodations to make it easier to get propensity evidence into the case in front of the jury. But this isn't a sexual abuse case. It's a business records falsification case. So he shouldn't have been able to get that evidence in, and he won't. The second thing, Noah, which I think is an important ruling, and I'm glad he made it, it's something I've been complaining about for a couple of years, and I was particularly offended to read it in Bragg's statement of facts. The judge ruled this week that Michael Cohen's guilty plea to campaign finance violations is not admissible evidence that Trump committed campaign finance violations. That's an important ruling. It's a legally correct ruling. One defendant is not guilty just because another defendant has pled guilty. But in this case, it's especially important because what happened with Cohen is the Southern District of New York, my old office, had him dead to rights on tax evasion charges and false statements to financial institutions. The tax evasion was in excess of $4 million. Those crimes Trump didn't have anything to do with, but they drove his sentencing guidelines in the case that the Southern District was bringing against him, and he was looking at a certain prison sentence. And what happened at that point was he and his lawyers suggested to the Southern District that he might have information about Trump that they could use. And he knew they were interested in trying to make a case against Trump. So they had found some stuff in his, when they searched his workplace, and I think they searched his workplace and his home. But they found some correspondence between him and Pecker that related to Stormy Daniels. And I'm going to skip by the fact that we have a Pecker in the middle of all this. I don't think we need to dwell on that long.
Sorted enough as it is.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I think what happened with Cohen is it was a no-lose proposition for him to plead guilty to two campaign finance violations that I don't believe he committed, because these are not campaign expenditures. It didn't add anything to his sentencing guidelines, because those were driven by the financial crimes that they already had him on. But he was trying to sell himself as an attractive witness against Trump. So being willing to go into court and say, I'm guilty and Donald Trump directed me to do this, was the way he tried to sell himself as a witness. As it turns out, he's so dishonest, and he ended up pleading guilty to perjury in connection with the Mueller investigation. So he's already a convicted perjurer. But he's such a disaster in terms of his credibility that the Southern District decided he wasn't usable, and they certainly wouldn't premise a case on him. So rather than write him what he was expecting, which was a motion to the judge so that he could be sentenced to time served and do no jail time on his case, they instead filed a sentencing memorandum that laid out what a dishonest guy he is. And the judge sent him to jail for 3 years. And now he claims that when he said under oath that he was guilty of tax evasion, he was lying. So a federal judge 2 weeks ago said that he committed perjury either when he pled or when he testified that when he pled, he was lying. So I think the Southern District has probably proved prudent not to have built a case on Cohen.
All right. Well, that's going to be going on for several weeks. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court this week heard oral arguments in Fisher v. United States, which centers on the questions involving the proper use of felony charges against some of those who were convicted of obstructing an official proceeding in relation to their participation in the January 6th riots. In arguments yesterday, the general consensus among the justices, the majority of justices, seemed to be apprehension with the Justice Department's application of the statute, which makes it a felony to, quote, corruptly alter, destroy, or mutilate a record with the intent of making it unavailable for the use in a, quote, official proceeding, or to, quote, otherwise obstruct, influence, or impede such proceedings. A lot of quotes there, but they're all very important. So critics of the DOJ's approach to this say that this statute was designed to prevent evidence tampering, not to prosecute what happened on January 6th. And the majority of justices seem to agree, which would mean the court would overturn some of the convictions of the January 6th convicts, forcing the DOJ to reopen those cases.
Yeah, that's right. So I think Justice Thomas, who didn't used to ask any questions at all in oral argument, but during COVID started to ask, and now they have a kind of a procedure that they've adopted for oral argument that they've carried over from COVID, which is after the lawyers do their spiel and the justices can all interrupt them with questions, Chief Justice Roberts goes through the roster from the most senior to the least senior judge and lets them all have a round of questioning to themselves. And that's gotten Justice Thomas to become a more active questioner than he was in his first years on the court. So yesterday
decades.
At the
first decades. On the court.
Yeah, really. Because I think he's become, is it the eighth longest serving? It was in the last few days. I think he's like the seventh or eighth longest serving member on the court. And if he lasts through,
it was 91 were his hearings for appointment to the court. I think
it was the Bush 41 administration. So that's right. I think 91, I think 91, presided over by Senator Biden of all people.
To his eternal disgrace, the left has never forgiven him for allowing him to send to the court.
But I think somebody said if he sits through 2025, he would be the second longest serving judge after William O. Douglas. He'll have a while to catch Douglas, but In any event, he asked the first question of the day, and it really is the defining question. What he says is, when we see otherwise in the statute, do we read what goes before it, or do we read what goes after it? And that really is what the case comes down to. The court has a statutory construction canon that it actually just issued a short opinion about last week. The canon is called a justum generis. And what it essentially says is that if you have a general term, it has to be understood in relation to the more specific terms that it is coupled with. So otherwise obstructs is a general term. And under the way the court interprets that canon, what otherwise should mean is informed by the specific terms that go before otherwise, which would be things like altering, destroying, mutilating, or concealing a record, document, or other object. In other words, that interpretation means that this statute is about spoliation of evidence. The Justice Department, by contrast, says that because this was enacted, the part we're dealing with is it's Section 1512, but the provision is C2. That alters, destroys, and mutilates stuff that I just mentioned is in C1. Sarbanes-Oxley added C2, as you mentioned, to cover a gulf in the law that made it hard to prosecute some people who shredded evidence or, you know, otherwise manipulated it. So what they did in C2 was they enacted this add-on that says whoever corruptly otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes an official proceeding. Because it was added in that way, like as a standalone, the Justice Department wants it to be read as a standalone. So they say it doesn't really matter what goes before it. What matters is what comes after it. So it's otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding. In other words, what they're saying is this doesn't have to be about spoliation of evidence. It was a catch-all that was intended to address any conceivable way of obstructing a proceeding. And what rankles the conservatives on the court is this implicates yet another doctrine of interpretation, which is, well, a couple of principles. One is that criminal laws are supposed to be written with a lack of ambiguity and with specificity so that a person of average intelligence can know what the law forbids. And the corollary to that, which is a kind of a separation of powers principle, is that Congress writes the laws and prosecutors enforce the laws that Congress has written. Prosecutors don't get to make up crimes. And Congress is not supposed to write statutes in a kind of an open-ended way so that they have, sort of curtilage that the prosecutors can go out and try to expand and explore, because that cuts against the idea that people are supposed to know what the law already prohibits. They're not supposed to act in ambiguity. They're not supposed to act under circumstances where their lawful actions might be discouraged from taking actions that would be otherwise lawful because they're confused about what the law actually prohibits. So this is a long-winded way of saying what the justices are concerned about in these areas is the breadth of a statute. So if the government wants to argue for an interpretation, an open-ended interpretation of anything that obstructs, influences, or impedes, what the justices want to know is what's the limiting principle? Is there some way of impeding a proceeding that doesn't fall into that language? Is there something that you're saying that limits or restricts what prosecutors can do here? Or is it just a crapshoot? They can, you know, anything they see that they think might have an influence on a proceeding is something that could be obstruction. And the other, let me just throw in one other thing in the mix, Noah, because I think this is important. The other thing that open-ended statutes invite, besides prosecutorial creativity, which the court wants to discourage, is also arbitrary enforcement. And what the court pressed the Justice Department on is there any other instance where this statute has been employed this way so that the obstruction theory is not that anyone despoiled evidence, but that you prevented the proceeding from happening in the first place by this destructive activity, the Capitol, you know, the riot at the Capitol. I think it was Justice Gorsuch asked the most pointed questions in this regard. It was clear he was talking about Congressman Jamal Bowman, but he says, what say you had a congressman who didn't want Congress to take a vote? So he pulls a fire alarm and then everybody has to evacuate and they cancel the vote and they have to reconvene later. Have you ever prosecuted a case like, have you ever had a case like that? And have you brought charges? And then they point, they could also point to the, you know, the firebombing of the federal courthouse in Portland, which shut down all the proceedings there, for a number of days, not for 3.5 hours, for a number of days. And then, of course, there was the storming of the Capitol and the physical intimidation of a number of senators during the Kavanaugh.
Yeah, but you don't need a separate statute to prosecute any of that.
No, but you need to show that you're enforcing. If you want the justices to think that this is something you should be allowed to do, you need to have a track record that you're doing it fairly, so that you're developing principles that are not contingent on, you know, if you're a Democrat, you don't get prosecuted, and if you're a sympathizer of a Republican, you do.
To the politics of that, because it's clearly driving a lot of people crazy, and not just Democrats, but anybody who regards January 6th as a rather significant crime and is very leery of seeing these convictions overturned because of the political narrative that would accompany it. So I want to read you the CNN write-up I was reading this morning, which seems designed, calibrated in a laboratory to drive you crazy. It attacked the conservative justices for introducing, quote, whataboutism, precisely what you just described, that, you know, those... The fire alarm scenario and the firebombing of the court scenario. It mourned the degree to which nobody in the oral arguments introduced, quote, their, quote, recognition of the traumatic and deadly nature of those events. So there were just not enough theatrics to satisfy CNN's reporters. And it turned the liberal justices into hard-nosed textualists because they were just, you know, dispassionately reading the letter of the law while the conservatives were flailing about trying to find a new theory of the case. I understand the political narrative here that would accompany the overturning of some of these convictions, but it seems a lot of garment rending to me, because if the DOJ just reopened these cases, they would go after these violators for existing statutory violations. They're trespassing, general misconduct, you know, half a dozen other charges that you could bring that maybe wouldn't have as serious sentencing guidelines, but are nevertheless something you could pretty easily convict on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, look, first of all, whataboutism is what we do in the law. I always love that criticism. You know, I mean, precedent is what we do in the law. That's what the whole process of applying jurisprudence is. Is this case similar to that case, or is it similar to this other case? So I'm not very sympathetic to the whataboutism criticism, even politically, but in the law, it doesn't make any sense because whataboutism is basically what we do. Secondly, if you're talking about people who broke into the Capitol, like did physical damage to the building, or people who assaulted police, who are the two most serious categories of offenders, they can be prosecuted for those crimes and get very hefty sentences, and a number of them have been. The third thing I would point out is that most of these people are not going to have their convictions overturned. Most of the people who pled guilty to this statute did it under the standard Justice Department plea agreement, where in order to get whatever plea deal they're offering you, you waive your right to appeal. So as to those people, even if the Supreme Court rules that the Justice Department has improperly applied the statute, if you didn't preserve your right to appeal, you're done. You're not going to benefit from this ruling. This is going to have more prospective effect than effect on existing cases. But, you know, the basic rule is you can't, you know, we have ex post facto principles. You can't prosecute people just because you think they're bad in the abstract, like, and you think what they did is bad. What you have to have is an actual statute from Congress that makes the conduct illegal, and then you can apply it. And what the court has been pushing against, and it's not just in this case, it's in a number of cases going back a number of years. Rich and I have talked a couple of times about the convictions of those two Cuomo cronies that got thrown out, I want to say about 2 years ago. Percoco and Ciminelli were the two cases where the court basically chastised the Justice Department to say that the term fraud in federal law is a financial crime. It's not a prosecutor's vehicle for criminalizing every deceptive scheme in order to impose somebody's idea of what good governance is. If you don't have a financial crime, you don't have a fraud. So the court has been pushing back on this idea that the prosecutors can make up new crimes by stretching statutes that were meant to apply to other situations just because the prosecutors think in the abstract, this is terrible behavior. There must be some way we can make it criminal. So that's the issue. And it's interesting, Noah, when you say that the progressives have become textualists, this is really the
same. That was
second-
on me. I'm going to give that to CNN.
Well, but it's
their assertion is that the liberal justices are just really just reading the letter of the law, while the conservatives are doing everything they possibly can to get to the outcome they want, which is to get the rioters off.
Yeah, well, look, as a conservative, I think there's a lot to that critique, and where we've seen it the most is in connection with the court's new line of jurisprudence on this this important public question doctrine. You know, where we've had these administrative agencies. I think this came up in the student loan case, and it's come up in some of these other administrative law cases, where the Biden administration scours the regulations for a law that looks ostensibly like it may let them do something like modify loans, and they therefore find an elephant in one of Justice Scalia's mouse holes, right? They say, oh, this allows us to forgive $400 billion worth of student loan debt, right? And what the court has developed is this doctrine that says, if it's an important public question, we expect that Congress is going to have been clear about the authority that they were giving to the administrative agencies, because Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes, as Scalia used to say. And what Justice Kagan's response to that has been is that this is the conservatives pivoting because the text of the statute, which they said they were wedded to, actually does allow the agencies to do these things if you read it literally. And now they're adding on another requirement because they don't like the result. So she has quipped, also borrowing from Justice Scalia, when she says, you know, she used to say, she said in her confirmation hearings, I believe, we're all textualists now because of Scalia. And what Kagan has said is, well, they like to say they're all textualists now. Turns out they were kidding. And she makes this critique every time one of these cases comes up. And I don't think it's not a frivolous argument. I don't happen to agree with it under the totality of the circumstances, but there's nothing frivolous about it.
Yeah, Kagan knows what she's doing. And so, unfortunately, I don't think we actually have enough time to get to the other events on the planet Earth that have nothing to do with Donald Trump or January 6th. They do kind of tend to absorb our attention for a lot of reasons, but those events aren't going anywhere. They'll be here next week, and that's all the time we have today. So when Rich is back next week, he will get to those events and your experience with them, particularly with regards to terrorism and the prosecution of Hezbollah terrorists. I want to tee that up because I don't want that to slip under the radar. It's going to be extremely relevant in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, you've been listening to a National Review podcast. It has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thank you to all of you for listening. Rich will be back next week, and we'll see you then.